Welcome to the Veritas Forum, engaging university students and faculty in discussions about life's hardest questions and the relevance of Jesus Christ to all of life. For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org. The following material is copyrighted and may not be duplicated, reproduced, or redistributed without prior written consent from the Veritas Forum. Join us as we explore true life.
Number one, Jesus died by crucifixion. And two, was buried. Three, Jesus' death caused the disciples to despair and lose hope, believing that his life was ended. Four, although not as widely accepted, many scholars hold that the tomb in which Jesus was buried was discovered to be empty just a few days later. Five, the disciples had experienced which they believe were the literal appearances of the risen Jesus. And six, the disciples were transformed from doubters who were afraid to identify themselves with Jesus to bold proclaimers of his death and resurrection. Seven, this message was the center of preaching in the early church. And eight, was especially proclaimed in Jerusalem, where Jesus died and was buried shortly before. As a result of this preaching, nine, the church was born and grew. 10, was Sunday as the primary day of worship. 11, James, who had been a skeptic, was converted to the faith when he also believed that he saw the resurrected Jesus. And 12, a few years later, Paul was converted by an experience which he likewise believed to be an appearance of the risen Jesus. So, perhaps now, Professor Flew, you could say what areas you agree or disagree in.
Crucified, yes, of course. Abundant evidence for that. Dead, I think so, but wait a moment. Pilate, who undoubtedly had experience of crucifixions, was surprised that Jesus was, you know, finally dead at that time, and then he was taken down. Now, in view of other things that have become known now, there are possibilities of some sort of revival. Now, the next thing, surely, do we have evidence of the actual burial? Yes, we have evidence that Joseph of Arimathea was proposing to bury Jesus, and we also have evidence of the tomb being empty. But what I think we don't have evidence of it is of its being occupied. And a rather different line I want to take at some later stage. Granted that he rose from the dead and was moving around, what is the next stage? Presumably he's not buried again. He is presumably goes up to heaven. Now, what is involved in this? Is the body supposed to rise up and somehow disappear? I don't think we have any information about what is even expected to have happened there. To complete a resurrection, surely, we've got to have a death and presumably an actual burial and then another stage about which nothing clear seems to have been said.
Okay. Would you like to react to the worries?
I would love to react. In probably 2 minutes or less, no. Okay. Notice he said Jesus was crucified, and you said, I think he died, but something like that. I think, but not positive, or the think, but let's just look at this, something like that.
Well, that Pilate thought he was
right.
Dead, but very early, you know. And Pilate was surprised at a report of death, and he, after all, had in that rebellious Jewish part of the empire experience of crucifying other people.
That was in Mark 15. Let me ask you a question. So you like Mark,
mm-hmm.
right? Mark's a good source. Okay. All right, let me make a few comments about crucifixion. We know a lot about crucifixion today and what happens on the cross because, well, for a couple of reasons. Unfortunately, some people have been crucified in recent history, but a number of medical doctors have actually asked for, I want to say victims, but more like volunteers, to be crucified. I know one of those medical doctors who asked for volunteers to come in and get up on a cross. And what they find out is this. You don't fake, and I know you're not saying Jesus fake necessarily, but you don't get down off the cross alive. And here's what happens. When you're hanging, and it doesn't have to be nails, it doesn't even have to be a cross, it could be the monkey bars if you're hanging long enough. But here's what happens. When you're hanging in this position with your arms above your head, the weight of your body pulls down on the muscles surrounding your lungs, the intercostal pectoral deltoid muscles, the same muscles you work out when you're, you know, doing weights or something. And they constrict your lungs when the weight of your body pulls down on them. And the way you relieve that, when you're in the low position on the cross, when you're in low position where your knees are bent and you're slumped down, you begin asphyxiating. And you die fairly quickly if you don't do something about it. An experiment in Cologne, Germany, done by a medical doctor some years ago, the males who volunteered, all they did was tie these guys to 2x4s. That's all they did. And they lost consciousness at a maximum of 12 minutes. 12 minutes. So you can't hang on the monkey bars that long, but theoretically, they lost consciousness 12 minutes. So what you do on the cross, the guys in the experiment, their feet were hanging. If your feet are tied or nailed, you push up. And you push up into a position where you relieve those muscles around your lungs. But you can't stand there very long. Because especially if you're on nails, but when you're pushing up, you're going against gravity and you're pulling, and it's difficult to keep doing this. You can basically stay alive as long as you can keep pushing up and down. When you can't push anymore, you slump down to the low position and it's over relatively quickly. So for a centurion not to be sure that Jesus died on the cross, he would have to be so unaware of crucifixions is to think that when a man is standing up and heaving, that he's dead. If you're down in the low position for, let's say, 15 minutes, let's say 30 minutes for sure, they're pretty much sure he's dead. Now, I invite you to check this out. There have been articles published, dozens of articles published in medical journals, one about 15 years ago in the Journal of the American Medical Association. In fact, in that article, three scholars, including a pathologist from Mayo Clinic, wrote Jesus' death certificate. And they said he died due to asphyxiation complicated by shock and congestive heart failure. That's one. Secondly, it was common, and we have a bunch of references to this in ancient history, to people doing a death blow, so to speak, a coup de grace to somebody on the cross. We have a case where a person was threatened with a bow and arrow. We have a case where a guy had a skull cracked open before he died. And we learn in the same gospel, Mark, and the other gospels, we learn, actually, let me back up. This one's not a mark. But they would break ankles. And you can figure out now why they do that. If you break ankles, the person can't push back up again, and they asphyxiate. They did not break Jesus' ankles, we're told. We're told they stabbed him in the chest. We have two other cases outside the New Testament where people were stabbed. And we're told blood and water came out. The major medical explanation is that around the heart, there's a sac that's called the pericardium, and it holds a thin, watery fluid. And so they believe, these medical doctors, many others, this is almost unanimous among the medical doctors who study this, they believed he was stabbed in the chest. He was stabbed in the chest, but they believe he was stabbed in the heart because that's how you get the water out of the sac around the heart. And so in that article, they concluded he was dead when the spear entered his body, but if he was not, the spear wound would have killed him. Now, I'll shorten the last point, but I'll make a real quick point here. These are not the main reason why scholars don't accept this wound theory today. Almost nobody believes this. In fact, John Dominic Crossan, no friend to evangelical Christianity, co-founder of the Jesus Seminar, John Dominic Crossan said, the fact that Jesus died by crucifixion is as sure as any fact could be in the ancient world. Now, why would he say that? You've got the asphyxiation, you've got the heart wound. But thirdly, David Strauss, 150 years ago, said the problem with the swoon theory is that there's a logical problem, and that is nobody who was weak and sickly and had thought he was dead, but he came forward later. You know, we talked about this. If he showed himself to the disciples, the problem is they would think he was alive, but they would never think he was risen. Not if he's sweating and bent over and the wounds opened again. He hasn't even washed his hair. He's dripping blood. There's a path behind him of blood. They would never think he was raised. They would only think he was alive. And here's the problem, Strauss said. Strauss, by the way, was probably the most liberal of the 19th century German liberals. That was their formal name, German liberalism. Strauss said the disciples would get a doctor before they proclaimed him risen, because he would convince them he was alive. But if there's no risen Jesus, there's nothing the church can get excited about. There's nothing for the church teachings to be based on. If he's raised, if he's alive, that's great. But if he's not raised, if they didn't believe he was raised, there'd be no basis for a church. I mean, you could imagine Peter over in the corner when Jesus struggles into the room. Peter coming over in the corner saying, "Oh boy, someday I'm going to have a resurrection body just like his." Because over 20 times in the New Testament, for good or for ill, we're told that believers would be raised like Jesus. The point is they couldn't believe that if they thought he was alive but not raised. So anyway, sorry I took so long on the explanation, but there's just a few thoughts for you. I don't know if you want me to talk about the burial too, but go ahead. You respond.
I don't know the extent to which your reservations about the resurrection hang on your reservations about the actual death. But if you want to say more about
you
that,
you gave yourself way out so. There. You said you think he died. So.
Well, yes. Okay. Yes, I think this does carry it. I still am puzzled about what evidence there is that there was actual burial, because, as you know, that I believe the resurrection appearances were grief-related. I don't know whether you call them visions or just experiences.
Sure.
The existence of which there is apparently immensely strong evidence, and they are apparently fairly common, though I had never heard of them at all in my in life of injury. No friend of ours and had ever had one of these grief-related experiences, but apparently they are common. So that's the line I'm inclined to take. And these experiences would clearly be experience of the dead person as they were when they were alive. So they wouldn't be experiences of a broken person at all. That's the line I would... But I'd still like to know about the whether there was an actual burial or evidence for an actual burial.
What do you think about the questions about his death? Are you satisfied on... Do you think that that's...
Yes, I should have thought so, yes.
Okay, good.
That in view of your evidence about the effects of crucifixion, it would suggest that this is a much quicker death than people have thought that it was.
Well, people could be on the cross for days, and that's probably why Pilate asked that question. They could be on the cross for days. It depends on how long you can keep pushing up and down. But don't forget, he was beaten 3 times.
Yeah.
And so I think some extraordinary things were done in his case.
Mm-hmm.
And so that probably shortened. And he was on the cross, after all, for 6 hours by mm-hmm. the timing.
Yeah.
So, well, you want me to talk about the burial? Okay. First of all, I would say this right off the bat. Whether he was buried or not buried, that doesn't play a role in crucifixion. That doesn't play a role in resurrection discussions to me. If a person's dead, you could have no idea where they were. But if they're dead and you see them again, now that's an issue. But let's talk about the burial for a few moments. Here's some of the data we have for the burial. It's reported in all four Gospels. So you have multiple attestation, because if you're used to New Testament, the way New Testament critics speak, the four Gospels are not one source, they're not four sources. There's different ways of figuring this out, and that's a long theory. But you have multiple attestation, because everything we have says he was buried in the tomb. Nothing contrary. Nothing to the contrary. Thirdly, you have you have leaders who were at the cross who wanted him to die. You had Romans, you had some of the Jewish leaders that you mentioned. And it would be incredible to me if they thought they just let him go and said, oh, we don't care about the body. You know, I think they want to see this thing through to completion. And further, we have a report that's recorded in Matthew. It's recorded in two early writers, Justin Martyr, Tertullian. Both tell us that Jewish observers admitted the tomb was empty. Now, that'd be a pretty incredible admission if there was no burial in a tomb. So there's four considerations. Another one is most scholars believe that behind the Gospel of Mark, there's what's called a pre-Markan passion narrative. This Mark is already early, about 35 years after the cross. They think the source is, obviously, if it's a source, it's even earlier. And this source gives you the data. So, I mean, that's five. Here's a quick sixth one. I can give you others if you want. But I think maybe the best witness to burial is the fact that all four Gospels don't just report it, but they report that besides the men you mentioned, Joseph and Nicodemus, the women were present, and they were the first ones there on Sunday morning. The reason this is so significant is not to offend any of the ladies here tonight, but in a Mediterranean world, especially in Jewish Mediterranean world, in general, there's exceptions, but in general, women were not allowed to testify in a court of law. Now, sometimes they were very kind to the women. Sometimes, for example, one ancient reference says, don't ask women, all they do is lie. But another reference says, women's testimony is more trustworthy than men. So you do get some mixed comments. But my point is, if you're making up an account and you don't think people are going to accept the testimony that all the earliest witnesses were women, if you're making it up, you don't make them your chief witnesses because people don't accept the story in the first place. So there's, I don't know what number, that's seventh. We could do some others, but I think that's probably the reason why virtually nobody has any, you know, if he's dead, he's got to be buried somewhere, you know. So, what do you think?
Yes.
Okay.
He does have to be buried somewhere, but not necessarily in the official tomb.
But all those reasons are reasons for burial in the tomb. But yeah. Like I said, I mean, ultimately, I think that's, you know, for the ancient world, 7-8 reasons, that's a lot of reasons. But ultimately, somebody, it's possible to not, this is not my view, but I mean, somebody could say, well, I don't know what happened to the burial. The issue is dead and alive, not dead, buried and alive. It's just dead and alive. If you're dead, you ought not be alive. So that's the issue.
Let me write that down.
Yeah.
Yes.
But, of course, the Jewish opposition was much concerned about that this death should be final.
I'm sure. You're right.
The whole point of the thing.
Sure. And the more they wanted to be sure he was dead, that's more reason to believe he was both dead and buried, because they would want to see the process through, right? I mean, they wouldn't just walk away and leave him up there. They'd want to make sure they saw this thing to completion. That, by the way, is what we are told in the Gospel of Matthew.
Yes. Their refusal to believe after this, I suppose the refusal was to believe in somehow a drastic continuation of the supposedly resurrected life, wasn't it? They wanted this to be a final end to this distressing opposition to the official line.
You know, you mentioned the Book of Acts this afternoon in your lecture, being a pretty good source. There's an enigmatic reference. It's a half a verse long. It's in Acts 6. We're not given any reasons, but it says something like, one of the points up there is that the church was founded and Christianity spread, obviously. And it says in Acts 6, it said, and a large number of priests became obedient to the faith. No reasons are given. That's just a really interesting little tiny half verse there about people whose job it was to make sure that this thing wasn't, as you say, you know, it was, that it was a good job.
What was going on in Jerusalem was a very puzzling thing, wasn't it? Both the opposition and the support. There was a very big conflict between the official view of the Pharisee party and the Christians.
Yes, by the way, I think the fact that it happened in Jerusalem is one more reason for one of the additional ones we could give for the burial. If I proclaimed that there's a local holy man and he died and he's been buried in your town here, and I say, hey, funny thing, it's 3 days later, the grave is empty, go see for yourself. If I said this happened in Monterey, I imagine most of you won't go. If I said it happened in Rome, I imagine most of you won't go. If I said this happened in Tokyo, I imagine most of you won't go. But if I said it's at the end of your street or it's 5 blocks away, I imagine some people are going to check this thing out. So Jerusalem is the last place the empty tomb should have been proclaimed, unless it was empty. Right? Because any number of people could have taken a Sunday afternoon stroll and gotten there easily enough. And so that's the last place to proclaim the message. The fact that it was proclaimed in the city is one more reason to think, you know, there are checks and balances in this town. People can tell if their proclamation is true.
Yeah.
And nobody disputes the fact that the earliest preaching was in Jerusalem.
No. Yes, this is the whole event in Jerusalem. It is the crucial place, isn't it?
Right.
Coming up from the backwoods to Jerusalem, the crucial challenge to the traditional authority. I mean, going into the temple, of course, is to provoke the traditional authority, isn't it?
Even Rome, even a thorn in Rome's side, because you read Suetonius or others, and Rome had emperor worship.
Yeah.
And you remember Pilate's questions, you know.
Yeah.
Are you he's claiming to be the, he wanted to know who he thought he was. And I don't think Jesus was any kind of a threat. You were talking about how peaceable he was this afternoon. Mm-hmm. I don't think he was any kind of a threat to Roman regime, but they may have thought that with large crowds and Passover time.
Almost certainly, because the Jewish people were a major threat to the Roman imperial regime, really. They were, and they were much more numerous, actually, than is generally believed, because of the very large number of Jews who'd moved into other parts of the empire outside the area of roughly the modern Israel. They were a large, exceptionally educated, and in a way, from the point of view of the emperor, exceptionally troublesome group.
Well, of course, at Passover time, they come back to Jerusalem. Yeah. So this is already a rough time of the year for the Roman soldiers.
And the Romans had had one or two, and were going to have another major conflict with the Jews as a rebellious group.
66 AD.
Quite, yes.
Well, you have some qualms, but it sounds to me, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds to me you're virtually conceding that perhaps you can accept these as relatively uncontroversial. So my best guess is you think there's a better explanation for these, if they are facts, than the actual resurrection.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you could say something about that.
Well, the actual belief in the resurrection is more than the belief that Jesus was, resurrected. It's what's supposed to have happened later, his acquiring a status of somehow more than a chap who has been so fortunate as to be resurrected, of whom there are so other biblical examples, aren't they? I mean, Lazarus, for instance, is supposed to have been after a longer period of death, actually. And there are at least two, one in 1 Kings and one in 2 Kings, And I believe there may be some other oddments elsewhere in the Bible, but there are all these. And clearly, this isn't from the point of view of the establishment of the essentials of the Christian religion, anything like the whole story about the resurrection. I mean, of course, the nature of the being resurrected makes this more exciting than any of the others because of, to put it mildly, the charismatic character of Jesus. After my recent comparisons with the prophet of Islam, I mean, the resurrection of Jesus in view of his life and sayings and so on is clearly going to be of more world historical interest than the resurrection of Lazarus. And it's the something more that I am altogether unclear about.
Especially if, as Christians believe, Lazarus had to die again and Jesus didn't.
Right.
So obviously, yes, that makes, yeah, all the difference in,
yes,
the world.
It clearly does, yes.
Especially given Jesus' claims.
Exactly so, yes.
Because for claims, I mean, just humanly speaking, if he made extraordinary claims, which anybody can do, but if he made extraordinary claims, and they are extraordinary, I mean, I don't think there's a parallel in the history of religions, but he makes extraordinary claims, and if he's raised from the dead, well, I mean, dead people don't do much, so if he's dead, he's not going to be acting upon himself.
Quite.
And so if he's made extraordinary claims, and if, as he claimed, he's acted upon by another to be raised, now people are asking, and I think justly, whoa, who's this guy supposed to be? Mm-hmm. You know, because in the New Testament, the resurrection is the evidence of the claims. Hence its centrality, one of the facts we put up there. So, obviously, you don't believe in the resurrection. What do you think is a better explanation of the data?
Well, I'm wanting to know, what is the something more other than the character of Jesus himself, which makes this of special significance? I mean, surely he's supposed to go to another place, isn't he?
I think the best evidence we have for resurrection is the Apostle Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter how skeptical you get, I mean, people like Michael Martin and G.A. Wells concede that Paul was an eyewitness to what he believed was the resurrection appearance of Jesus. One of the facts up there. James, the brother of Jesus, same thing, who was an unbeliever during Jesus' life. That's conceded by virtually everybody. These two men, James, the brother of Jesus, and Paul, are unbelievers until they think they meet the risen Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Paul's testimony we have firsthand, and that's what makes him such a powerful witness.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Because Paul says a couple of times in 1 Corinthians 15, I mean, I'm not even aware of a well-known New Testament scholar who denies the Pauline authorship of 1 Corinthians. And he says, am I not an apostle? Have I not seen the Lord? Then in chapter 15, he gives data that he received from somebody else. He said, I gave unto you what I also received. Jesus died for our sins according to the Scriptures, was buried, rose again the third day according to the Scriptures, and appeared. And he lists appearances to individuals and groups. And last of all, he says, last of all, he appeared to me. And then he says three verses later, he says, whether it's I or the other apostles, this is what we preach. So Paul not only has given his own experience, he's our best window we have on the other apostles and what they were preaching. Galatians 1 and 2, another undoubtedly Pauline book. G.A. Wells grants it, so that tells you something. In Galatians 1 and 2, twice, and maybe three times, Paul makes trips up to Jerusalem. He met with the three best-known Christians at that time. He met with Peter, John, and James, the brother of Jesus, who was a Christian before Paul. And he met with all three of them, and he said he checked out his gospel message of the death and resurrection of Jesus, and they agreed with him. So, I mean, today, we would call Paul, I mean this respectfully, but we would call Paul obsessive because he goes up to Jerusalem once, and that's just like getting on a plane and making an hour plane flight. You know, that's a pretty good trip. He goes up there once. He goes up there a second time in Galatians 2, and he may go up a third time, depending on what we think Acts 15 is. So he makes two or three trips to Jerusalem to talk to the main disciples to ascertain this message. And he said, they're preaching the same thing I am. So what you get here, you don't get a resurrection, but what you get is people who are totally convinced they saw the risen Jesus. Mm-hmm. And now what you have to ask is, how can we explain that data better?
But they are repeating, aren't they, substantially the things said earlier on by Jesus? Or are they uttering a new message?
I'm not sure what you're
well,
asking.
Roughly, they are repeating his claims, aren't they? They're not...
They're repeating their beliefs that they saw him. And so we have their testimony from a very early date. In fact, most critical scholars think we can date Paul's reception of this testimony to 35 A.D., which is only 5 years after the cross. Not the books themselves, but his trip to Jerusalem where he got this testimony. You can even work it out. If you put the cross at 30, Paul's conversion is usually put at 1 or 2 years later. Just say 2. That's 32. He tells us in Galatians 1 that 3 years later he went up to Jerusalem to talk to these guys. So 2 plus 3, 5, 35 AD. So Paul gives us the year markers right there in his works. And he tells us he went up there I think of a German historian like Hans von Kampenhausen who says these texts in Paul, 1 Corinthians 15, Galatians 1 and 2, he says they give us all the checks and balances that you would want from an ancient historical text. I mean, when you talk about ancient history, you talk about usually repetition of things that are a century or 2 centuries before.
Oh, yes.
And you get something from 5 years before, afterwards. And then, of course, Paul says, I gave you what I was given. So he was told this by the other disciples. They knew it before him. So there's no gap at all. You know, if he got this 5 years later, he's kind of a Johnny-come-lately. He's as he said, I was born out of due time, which is the word, by the way, in the Greek, 1 Corinthians 15, it's the word for... an abortion or for an aborted birth. He said that was him. And these guys were Christians before him, so there's no gap there at all. He got it 5 years later. They had it before he did.
Yeah. He has a similar vision. But surely there's supposed to be something extra, isn't there, about Jesus's future. We have, if we like, a resurrected Jesus for whom people are having visions and so on. It's supposed to have a wide... And he's supposed to be going somewhere, isn't he?
What troubles you about that?
Well, he's not going to be a continual... resident of the planet Earth, is it?
Why would that be an issue?
What?
If he was raised, he can kind of do anything he wants, can he? Why would going back to heaven in whatever form he went, why would that be an issue for somebody who was raised? I mean, I would think the much bigger miracle would be the resurrection, right? Let's put it this way. If he is who he claimed to be, and then he was raised... if he was who he said he was and he was raised to show it, I wouldn't stand in his way wherever he wanted to walk.
What he's claiming to be is the Son of God.
Right.
Now that seems to be a rather odd claim. I mean, not obvious to me how this claim of a special relationship to the ruler of the universe.
And he claimed it was a unique relationship, too. He said he was the only one who had this.
Well, yes, I can see why that should be claimed to be unique. But it's not clear to me what it's supposed to involve, really. I mean, we have a development of a doctrine of the Trinity, which is a difficult one, to put it mildly.
What would you do with the person who claimed to be the Son of God, who claimed to have a unique relationship to the God of the universe? He made some other pretty interesting claims, too. He claims to forgive sin, and when the leaders say, hey, you can't do that, that's blasphemy, and he says, well, to show you I can do it, I'll heal this man. He claims to be the Son of Man, which, contrary to popular opinion, is not a human claim. There's first century Jewish literature that we have that Son of Man literature is a very lofty claim. In fact, it probably eventually got him killed. But so he makes these claims about himself. He claims that only I have this in with the God of the universe. They say, well, how do we know this? And he says, well, because I'm going to rise from the dead. And he does it. Do you listen to him at that point? Do you think, uh-oh, this is getting too close for comfort?
Well, it certainly gets too close for comfort, yes. It's remaining a very perplexing claim, I think.
But the resurrection sort of puts his money where his mouth is, you know what I mean?
Oh, yes.
It's one thing to make a claim.
Oh, yes.
And then to be raised on top of it is rather special. First of all, we don't even have claims like that from the founders of the major world religions.
Certainly
so even the claim is rather extraordinary. That's to make it true. It just makes it very extraordinary. And then we don't have a claim that any other religious founder was raised, even by his Orthodox followers, even if you let them talk about it. So it just seems all around that this is exactly... I mean, certainly if you let Christians tell the story, it's very extraordinary.
We don't have claims to any miracles at all. And a point that Aquinas was eager to make in Summa Contra Gentiles was precisely that there are no miracles even claimed.
Of other founders.
About the founders.
That's correct.
Or, I think, any others, are there?
Well, at least the major founders. Yeah, Edwin Yamauchi, professor of ancient history, University of Miami of Ohio, said no other founder of a world religion, for no other founder of a world religion are miracles even claimed in the primary documents of a generation or so later. We have no other example of that.
I think that's right, yes.
And again, but they're claims, and then he puts everything on the resurrection. He says that's the big one, and then here he is. That's why Christians are excited about this.
Yes, yes.
Professor Flews, you seem to have shifted a bit here. Is your issue that the resurrection never took place, or the resurrection leads one to make fantastic claims about what it means to be the Son of God, or is it those sorts of claims, or is it the resurrection per se that you think there's a better explanation for it as a, you know, hallucination or something like this?
I am intensely puzzled by the whole situation here of what on earth is going on, even if you... grant the resurrection has occurred. This seems to me an event so extraordinary, I don't know what's to be said about it at all. And I don't believe in the objectivity of the appearances. You know, I can see that we have a claim that... The body was resurrected, but the claim to the resurrection seems to me based on the appearances.
That's fair.
And I don't think those appearances are an adequate basis of it. In all this, I think one ought to notice that experiences of claims to what is nowadays called the paranormal, what used to be investigated by what was called psychical research. Any claims to the genuineness of such occurrences have to be founded, if they're to be believed, on a really extraordinary amount of evidence. Indeed, anything that is conceived to be miraculous does need to be it, because one must approach any question about an alleged miracle with a pretty stubborn presumption that it didn't really happen. Because its extraordinariness depends on its being a unique event.